This is your In Demand with Alex and Lucy.
Imelda May, hello and welcome to the show.
Hello, Alex, how are you?
Really well, thank you. We should point out we're conducting this interview with sweets.
Yeah, you have to.
Because you're a little bit poorly.
Because I kind of eat sweets every day. Anyway, it's terrible. My teeth will fall out.
So welcome to the show for the first time.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a brief plot history about yourself, because you've been singing since you were quite young, haven't you?
Well, my mum says I came out singing. I don't know. A lot of information. But my sister was singing in church, and folk groups were really big in Ireland at that time. And so I was about four when I started with her. And she taught me harmonies and how to sing the different harmonies and my first chords on the guitar. So that was my first beginnings of it. And then I got into local variety shows, music and dancing groups in the local church halls and stuff.
Was that out of choice, or were you dragged to do that by your mum?
No, I loved it. It was my mother and other mothers opened it. They started this Liberties Music and Drama Group because there wasn't that much for the local kids to do. There was football for the boys. Girls hadn't got much. They ripped up all the playgrounds because of, teenage gangs hanging around them and then people making claims. So there wasn't much. So they started this up and it was really great. We all absolutely loved it, went mad for it. So we did loads of singing and dancing in it. And my dad and other dads made all the backdrops. It was a real local community effort, you know. It was great.
Yeah.
So I absolutely went mad for it. And then I just started singing in blues clubs and jam sessions. And I think being a 16-year-old blues singer was probably a novelty. So a lot of the local bands were really, really good to me and gave me great advice and told me what to do and what not to do and roughing up your voice. And so I learned the old-fashioned way, just from gigging and sitting in on gigs and listening and learning and getting good advice. So
that's the best way to do it, rather than going through the talent school pool or the reality show or something like that.
Great.
You've actually learnt it from, you know, the grassroots of it.
Yeah, it's a great way to learn, because you learn everything. Like, you learn how to keep it going when the lights go and the microphones fall or whatever collapses, and you learn how to do all that kind of side, the practical side of, you know, enjoying the gig as well and meeting musicians too.
Now, you remind me a little bit in terms of your story and kind of having that experience of being in burlesque clubs of Paloma Faith, because she comes from a similar kind of, and she's got a similar sound to you. I mean, you're different in terms of how your music is finally produced and how we hear it.
Yeah.
But she does have that kind of, she's got a similar sensibility about her.
Really?
And she's lovely as well. Now, you've been on the circuit for a while now. We're coming to sort of breaking yourself more in the UK. Mm-hmm. How has that been? Has that been a scary prospect, or is it something that you're just prepared to graft for because you want to achieve something and you know what you want?
It's not scary. It's not scary to try and do well, but it's not something that I'm all out for either. I'm an old-fashioned grafter, if you like, and I'll be doing this anyway. And I love pushing it to see what. It started off when I was in other people's bands. I sang in other bands for years, and from swing bands to, I sang a guy called Mike Sanchez, who does great rhythm and blues and boogie woogie, and I sang in all kinds of different bands doing that. And when I was making my living doing it, and because I'd work other jobs to keep music going, and when it came that I could get professional, I obviously needed more work to keep it going. So I did everything from weddings, funerals, the opening of a supermarket, and on a boat and stuff like that. On a barge, I actually did a gig once. And so I've done all of those kind of things. So when I started with my own band, because I've been writing myself for a long, long time, and I thought, I really want to do my own song. So I started with my own band, asked people that I'd worked with for many years if they wanted to join me, and they said yes. And when I started, I wanted to just improve the gigs as they went along. So that's what started it off, because a lot of the times I wouldn't get enough money to pay myself and or pay the band. I'd have to try and do other gigs, a function, say, to pay the band for the last gig that was done. And bit by bit, I just tried to improve things, because I'd say, oh, surely we can do better than this. And then we'd start to get a good following, and people came, and then they'd bring their friend, and then they'd bring a friend. And before you know it, the venues we were playing in were just getting bigger and bigger. And there was some kind of something happening, which was, it was a good buzz, a good feeling.
Imelda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to In Demand.
You're listening to In Demand with Alex and Lucy, and tonight Robin returns.
Yeah, one of our favourite guests. How are you? I'm good. How are you guys?
Very well. Very happy to have you back on the show again.
It's nice to be back.
So we're all ready for the release of Body Talk Part 2. Quite excited about this. Now, obviously, Hang With Me was an acoustic track on Body Talk Part 1, but now it's a lot funkier and ready for the discotheques.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The discotheques. You sound like my granddad.
It is. It's ready for the disco, and Indestructible will be for the next album.
Ah, see, I was going to ask you that because I noticed on the track listing Indestructible is acoustic on Body Talk Part 2. And then I was thinking, there's a pattern here. Is she going to soup that one up and put it on Body Talk Part 3? So you are.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be on the third album. You know, for me, it's been a nice way of like showing people another perspective of the singles and the songs that I feel like, you know, that was possible to do with. And I think, I hope that the acoustic version of Hang With Me gave people a little bit of like connection to the song.
Yeah, because the
version it is now.
The two songs are so different, even though they're the same song at the same time.
Yeah, which is nice because, you know, when you write them, you listen to them in so many different versions and you try them in different contexts and stuff. And it's a nice way of, like, putting a new perspective on the song.
The reviews of Body Talk Part 2 have already been brilliant. One of my favourites is when they call it a miniature feast. I think it was in The Guardian that said that. And I thought that's a really nice way of summing up an album.
Yeah. That must be a good thing, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you've worked with Snoop Dogg again on Body Talk Part 2. Did you actually get to properly hang out with him this time and
went to the studio for a couple of days in LA and hung out and talked about music and recorded stuff.
Do you ever get to sort of go out with Snoop and see how he lives his life?
No, we don't hang out. We just work together sometimes.
I can imagine his life's quite crazy.
Yeah.
No, I think his life's pretty pretty normal. He's a normal guy.
He is, yeah. I think nowadays he's obviously calmed down a lot. I mean, he's got his family and that kind of thing, hasn't he? He used to be known for being quite wild.
But I don't think any of us know enough about Snoop to have speculations about what his life is. But when I met him, he's a really down to earth person, and he's funny and very relaxed, want him to be.
I saw some of his reality show that he did with his kids, and it was brilliant. He's such a funny dad as well.
Yeah, he's funny. It'd
be pretty cool to have Snoop Dogg as your dad.
In Demand. You're listening to In Demand tonight with Alex and Lucy, as always, and tonight with Robin back on the show.
Yeah!
Now, there's a song on the new album, Body Talk Part 2, where you, let me get this right, you relate trannies to grannies, or are you just paying tribute to both?
This one's for the grannies.
Yeah, I'm just paying tribute to everyone, I think, on that song. The grannies and the trannies, too.
Yeah, because I mean, I imagine your music reaches people of all ages and all descriptions, to be fair.
Yes, that's what I imagine as well.
She's covered all bases with this album.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the fact you toured with Khalees recently on the All Hearts tour in the US. How did that go? Because she's pretty fierce and you're pretty fierce, so I can imagine it was a good, good night out.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think, or I know that our audiences really enjoyed us touring together. I mean, the crowds that we played for were amazing. I mean, it was such luxury to have this audience to perform to every night that was super excited and super engaged and danced and screamed and jumped around. And we were both really happy. And she's a cool chick. We had a really good time.
You've always been about female empowerment, especially through your music, Robin. Who is there sort of in the music industry nowadays that you think is managing to, from the ladies' perspective, managing to really nail it? Apart from someone like Khalees. Mm. Who else is in that same league, do you feel?
Well, I think at the moment there's so many girls doing so many different kinds of things. I think that's what I'm like. I'm happy about that because a lot of times before you've had like two female artists, like, you know, you've had Britney and Christina and then you had Mariah Carey and Whitney. And now there's this whole new kind of space where everyone's like allowed to do what they want. You have Lady Gaga and Rihanna you know, much bigger level, but they're also really expressing their personalities. And then you have other people like me and, you know,
I think you're
LaRue and all that stuff that's like doing our thing. And I think that's the cool thing about what's going on at the moment. And then that there's space for everyone and that everyone gets to express their own thing.
Well, Robin, thanks very much for chatting.
Thank you.
Best of luck with part 2. When will we get part 3? Do we know yet?
Yeah.
I don't know, so I don't think anyone else knows either.
Okay.
Let's hope this year.
Yeah. I'm thinking like a Christmas finale, a trilogy of all three.
Yeah. Let's hope for that. I'm in the studio right now, so it's like, yeah, as soon as I know, you'll know.
If there's a slight delay, don't worry, because we don't want you to burn out.
Oh, thank you.
We'd rather, you know, maybe wait till January if you need to take some time off.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to In Demand with Alex and Lucy.
So, Joe Dante, the legend.
I know.
Oh, we're so excited about chatting to you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for influencing our childhoods with such incredible movies like Gremlins.
And Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
Lucy's
what's
a big
the phrase, fan. What's the phrase? A legend in his own mind?
Absolutely. In our minds as well.
And I didn't realise until today, beg my pardon if this isn't true, but I thought that I found out that you did the voices for Gremlins as well.
Well, I didn't do them all, but I did some of them.
That's so cool.
Well, when you can't get people to do exactly what you want, you just sort of push them aside and do it yourself.
Exactly. And it worked. It worked brilliantly. And I was saying to Alex earlier, I think they need to somehow engineer a real life gizmo. We need real gremlins, but the nice ones.
Don't get it wet.
No.
Don't feed them after midnight.
And now you're back with this brand new movie. And you seem to have this incredible knack, Joe, at being able to tap into this adult mentality where you take us back to being young. And with the whole, this is kind of like the games you used to play as a kid. It looks like the things you used to make up in your mind are now coming to the big screen in 3D.
3D, yes. An extra dimension.
Okay. Now, when you were first sort of putting this film together, obviously you directed it. Did you put some ideas in for yourself as well? Were you behind the whole creative process too?
Well, no, actually I wasn't. The script came to me and it was better than most of the scripts that I get in this genre. And I suggested to the producers that we do it in 3D because it's a little more character driven than the usual horror film. And it's not a large film, a large canvas. It has, you know, not a lot of locations and not a lot of characters. But I did feel that if you could wrap the audience around the story, it would be very affecting. And so a certain amount of time is spent on developing the characters so that you feel that you understand them before you go into their fears, which are basically, you know, psychological fears that we all have. And we make them real in the film.
I think this is definitely a film that everyone can probably relate to as well. I mean, you know, when you're a kid and you're bored and there's nothing to do, you do kind of wish that something supernatural or something out of the ordinary would happen to you.
Yeah, that's true. And if you happen to be lucky enough to have a hole in your basement that's covered up by a door with locks, you know, then you have the added fun of trying to get the locks off.
Exactly. It's
that mystery of what lies behind things like that. I mean, most recently on TV, it was kind of like the hatch in Lost became like this mysterious what's behind it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you can play on that.
Pandora's box.
Yeah, completely.
And of course, you know, years ago, the Chronicles of Narnia. I mean, I remember being about 7 years old and attempting to see if there was anything beyond my wardrobe. There wasn't, but, you know, I tried.
How do you manage to sort of balance the character development without going too far immediately into the extreme of the special effects and what's down in the hole and stuff like that?
Well, you know, it's like you have a card and you don't know that you want to play it entirely at the beginning of the movie and then have to keep repeating it through the entire picture. You have to try to build up to certain things psychologically. And the trick is to make the characters interesting enough and the movie fun enough so that the audience doesn't mind the fact that they're waiting a little bit to see stuff. In the 50s, there was a tendency to make monster movies and they'd show the monster at the beginning of the movie and then it kind of shot their wad.
Yeah.
And you just sort of sit around waiting for him to come back. Whereas I was always more drawn to the movies that didn't show you the monster, but showed you what the monster did, showed you the evidence of what happened.
Is it a spider like it? Like Stephen King's It?
Do you have a spider phobia?
Alex does.
Oh my God, yeah.
I'm snakes.
Oh, really?
Mine is snakes.
Oh, well, my girlfriend's is snakes too.
Oh.
But Alex, don't see Tarantula, the giant spider movie from the 50s, because I saw that when I was about 8 years old and I was so scared that I was pacing in the lobby.
But it's one of those things actually, because you're so scared of something you become slightly obsessed with looking at it.
No,
so
yeah.
I actually always have to watch Arachnophobia when it's on TV.
Yeah.
Had to go and see Eight-Legged Freaks as well. Just kind of that morbid fascination.
And I'll watch documentaries on snakes.
Yeah.
And
so
it's the venomous ones that scare me the most, because you think, well, there's nothing you can really do if one bit.
Well, the problem with snakes we've found is that when you click on the channels, chances are there's going to be a snake somewhere, a shot of a snake. And and any movie that you watch that's got a jungle in it, there's going to be a snake.
Anaconda.
Joe, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you. Bye.
This is your In Demand.
Welcome to the show, Richard Jenkins, star of Eat, Pray, Love. So, Richard, without giving too much away, your character meets Julia Roberts' character, Liz, in India, and helps her realise a few truths about her life. Mm-hmm. But he is also facing a few truths of his own, is he not?
He is. He's a man of many demons.
Now, can you tell us what those demons are without revealing exactly what they are?
Well, you know, he had a lot of self-inflicted wounds, drugs, alcohol. You're a little irresponsible in his life, has done some things he's not proud of, and has decided to change his life and seek a healthier way, and chooses an ashram, has been going there for a while, still fighting, still struggling, but, you know, really believes in this world.
Now, there's a difference between kind of Richard's journey and Liz's journey, in that she is purposefully chosen to take a year out of her life mm-hmm. to kind of explore herself, so to speak. But Richard is doing this kind of intermittently, isn't he, with his own life back in Texas?
Yeah. He actually died in March. But he when I talked to him right before filming, he had just gotten back from the ashram. He was there for a few months. So he was devoted to it. He went as often as he could.
How did the project come to you in the first place? Had you read the book before it kind of crossed your desk as a script?
I read the book about a year before they approached me for the movie, and I loved it and loved this character. And so when Ryan Murphy asked me to do it, I jumped at it. I really love this guy.
He's a great guy, isn't he? He's a genius, so to speak.
He is. And Liz Gilbert just adored him. He was incredibly helpful to her, and they became devoted friends.
Visually as well, though, I mean, the countries that she visits, and it's great to read up on the film that you guys actually did go to these places.
Yeah. Robert Richardson, the cinematographer, who's brilliant, just really captured the feeling of these places. I know India, I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what it was like.
I think it's the first film I've seen that's portrayed India in such an honest way since Slumdog Millionaire. That did an incredible amount, obviously.
Yeah, that was incredible. Yeah, but India is an amazing place. It's like 100 places. I mean, there's different looks to it and feels. It's just amazing.
So, director, Mr. Ryan Murphy, obviously better known for his TV creations, especially with us at the moment with Glee here in the UK.
The juggernaut. Glee,
yeah. When you read Ryan's CV, it's quite frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, he's an impressive guy.
Has he offered you a role in any of his TV shows yet?
Well, he actually mentioned it the other night. I said, but I don't sing, Ryan, and I would never attempt it.
No?
I know Javier Bardem. He may be doing one of his shows, but maybe I'm speaking out of school here.
Ah, okay. Interesting piece of gossip.
I know Javier wanted to do Glee. I don't know what happened.
People are lining up for it now, though, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody wants to do Glee. I mean, Ryan's on the phone all the time. Yeah, but it's a fabulous show.
It is. It's amazing. Yeah. So just coming back to the movie one last time, what's the most important message that you would like people to take out of, more specifically, your scenes with Julia Roberts? What's the ultimate thing you want people to take from it?
It's hard to say what one should or shouldn't take from it, but what I take from it is that you're kind of in control of your life, and that if you there's a way out of issues and problems, and you can change. You can. I mean, it's internal, and you can do it, in your own backyard. You know, as Dorothy finds out, you don't have to go to India and Bali and Italy, but you ultimately are in charge.
Richard, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Good luck with the film. Take care.
You're listening to In Demand with Alex and Lucy.
You're listening to In Demand with Alex and Lucy, and tonight we've got Adam and Jesse from Maroon 5.
Hey, hello.
Yo.
Hello.
So it's good to be back with this amazing new single, Misery.
Yes.
Thank you.
Proper, just all over Maroon 5 sound, instantly recognisable.
Yeah, and as soon as you hear it, it's stuck in your head, which is always a good thing, nice and catchy.
I think we kind of embraced the fact that this is our sound, and we wanted to release a single that stamped the world.
Because some people tend to veer away from, say, that their previous sound or whatever. And for some reason, they seem to think they have to keep evolving in different ways. But for you guys, you've always had the same solid sound, and let's face it, it hasn't done you any harm.
No way.
No. Also, it's exciting to know that what we do is still kind of within the context of pop culture, which is always changing, almost week to week. Mm-hmm. It's still solid. It's still what people like. It's so funny too. Someone once told me, they said, someone that I really respect, actually, who I'm a big fan of, said to us, they said, you know, what's great about you guys is that, you know, your songs could be hits now or they could be hits 20 years ago. And that was always a really inspiring thing to think about, is what can, you know, in 10 years from, you know, first of all, it's been almost a decade since our first record. So
yeah, it's crazy.
It doesn't sound dated to me. It doesn't sound like it was recorded 10 years ago. And that's what's, that kind of consistency, I think, is good.
We need to talk video. Adam, you go through the motions in that video and then some. What was it like getting beaten up by your girlfriend?
Getting beaten up by my girlfriend. I'm going to write an essay right now. it was funny. You know, we've never made a funny video. All of our videos are so brooding and, you know, serious. And I think we've gotten a lot of shit for that. And so we just kind of thought to ourselves, let's just have fun with this. Let's not brood.
I mean, it's crazy.
It was really fun for her.
She's got lots of different methods.
It starts with a few slaps. Then you're hanging from a balcony. There's an Uzi involved at some point.
Knives.
I believe it's a grenade launcher.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. I don't know. I'm a girl. I look at a gun and go, it's a gun.
it's actually a grenade launcher.
Lucy thought it was a handbag. She's like, do I need one of these?
This
is next season's look.
It's beautiful.
The things we do for love.
I know. Well, this is it. But did you actually get any real life bruises from that? Because there's a scene where she's biting your ear and you actually look like you're in quite a lot of pain.
That's really funny that you say that, because it's absolutely true. I guess the director told me to really bite hard. And that shot was a genuine reaction to me being angry that she had bitten my ear as hard as she did.
Oh, my God.
There's no acting involved.
So you've actually got a piercing there now from her teeth?
I do. I have a tooth piercing.
And what was the – did you end up getting any bruises from the scene where she slams your head in the toilet door?
Well, that was actually the hardest. That was the hardest to do, because that actually did really involve real stunt work. I mean, some of the stuff, we didn't do any of the crazy things, but it was so cool working with these stunt coordinators, because they're brilliant, man, and they deserve to be noticed and paid more. And you know, people take that for granted. You know, when you see these guys jumping out of planes and doing death-defying acts, getting hit by cars. I mean, these guys are just demolished at the end of the day, and they deserve everything. You know,
Adam and Jesse, thank you.
Thank you.
Woo!
Yeah. This is your In Demand.